Chapter 17. Juan's Glock was still secured at the small of his back, so he grabbed the satellite phone in its waterproof bag and tackled Sloan around the waist, throwing them bodily over the rail and into the dark water. They began to swim frantically from the lifeboat, trying to put as much distance between themselves and the impending explosion. The rocket's dual electro-optic and infrared seeker stayed homed in on its target as it streaked across the sea, arrowing in on the plume of scorching exhaust from the lifeboat's engine. It slammed into the hull moments after being launched, punching a hole through the side and detonating just four of the engine block. Designed to core through a foot of armor, the shaped charge sliced the keel, breaking the lifeboat's back as debris was blown 30 feet into the air. The smoking, smoldering ruin folded almost in half as she sank, a gout of steam erupting when the sea made contact with the red-hot engine and manifolds. The overpressure wave was magnitudes greater than when Cabrillo blew up the truck's tank back at Walvis Bay, and had he not tossed himself and Sloan off the boat, they would have been crushed by its force. They floundered in the chaotic waves radiating from the blast site, spitting and sputtering water that they had inadvertently swallowed. Bicycling his feet to stay afloat, he reached for her to make sure she wasn't injured. "Don't ask me if I'm okay," she managed to say. "You've already asked me that a dozen times since yesterday." "It has been an exciting 24 hours, Juan admitted, towing off his shoes. "We have to get as far away from the boat as possible. They will almost certainly send someone out to investigate."
"We headed where I think we're headed?"
"Time to catch a ride on Papa Heinrich's snake." Though swimming a mile wasn't a difficult feat for two people in shape, battling the waves that crashed into them hampered every movement. It grew more difficult when a white luxury yacht identical to the one that had chased the penguin nosed its way into their area, the cyclopean eye of a searchlight cutting through the gathering dusk. It was the boat that had first caught Juan's eye, but it was what that boat had been tied to that commanded his attention.
"Must have gotten a buy-one-get-one deal on those babies," Juan said.
"Only BOGOs I get are at the supermarket for potato chips," Sloan quipped back. After 15 minutes of them swimming around to avoid the searchlight's powerful beam, the big yacht roared off into the darkness, giving Juan a bearing on which way to head, not that he thought he could miss their target. The cool water had begun to sap their strength. To make their job easier, Juan handed his Glock and the satellite phone to Sloan and shucked off his pants. He tied the legs closed at the cuffs and held the open waist into the wind so the pants filled with air. He quickly cinched them closed with the belt. He traded the makeshift flotation device to Sloan for his gun and phone. "Just make sure you keep one hand on the waistband so it doesn't leak air."
"I've heard about doing that, but I've never seen it done."
Sloane's teeth hadn't begun to chatter, but he could hear the strain in her voice. Juan said, "It was a lot easier practicing in a swimming pool." Now wasn't the time to tell her that the maneuver had saved his life on more than one occasion. Buoyed by the air-filled pants, Sloane swam much more strongly. And as they got closer to their destination, its massive size was acting like a damper for the waves.
"Do you feel that?" Sloan asked.
"What?"
"The water. It's warmer."
For a moment, Juan was afraid that Sloan's body was no longer fighting the cold, but rather succumbing to its icy tentacles. But then he felt it too. The water was warmer, and not just a degree or two, but as much as 10 or 15. He wondered if an active geothermal vent was causing such a temperature increase. Could that also explain the massive structure floating atop the waves? Did it somehow harness its power? What Papa Heinrich had called a metal snake was in fact a dull green pipe that Juan judged to be at least 30 feet in diameter, with all but the top 6 submerged. The pipe wasn't solid, however. It flexed along its length with each wave that passed under it. He judged his earlier estimate that the structure was 1,000 feet long to be accurate. The water was nearly 80 degrees when they finally reached the pipe. Juan placed his hand against the metal and felt it was warm to the touch. He could also feel the vibration of machinery from within the structure, massive pistons sawing back and forth with each thrust of the sea. They swam along its flank, keeping enough distance so a wave wouldn't smash them into it, and found one of the hinge points after a couple hundred feet. The sound of machinery was louder as the mechanism converted the action of the waves into potential energy of some kind. Rungs were welded to the side of the pipe to allow workers access to the massive hinge. Juan had Sloane climb up first. She had his pants deflated and untied by the time he joined her. She gasped. There was just enough light for her to see that below his knee, his right leg was a prosthesis.
"I'm sorry. That was rude," she whispered. "I had no idea. You don't limp or anything."
"Gotten used to it over the years," Juan replied, tapping the titanium strut that acted as his shin. "Parting shot from the Chinese Navy a few years back."
"I have to hear your life story."
Juan thrust aside thoughts about how George Adams could have missed the pipe when he reconnoitered the area from the Oregon's chopper. Instead, he steeled himself to the practicalities of their situation. He and Sloane were vulnerable as long as the men remained on the yacht tied up on the far end of the structure. There was no other option. He slipped into his pants and found an access hatch on top of the pipe. He opened it and saw there was a second hatch below. They'd explore later. He wedged the bag containing the satellite phone in the space between the two doors and locked the outer hatch closed. He took Sloane's hand so she would look him in the eye. "I can't afford to take prisoners because I don't know how long we're going to be stuck out here. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"You can stay here if you want, but I'm not ordering you to."
"I'll come with you and see how I feel when we get closer."
"Honest enough. Let's go." For the first 500 feet, they could walk in a crouch to keep from being seen by the yacht, but as they got closer, Juan ordered Sloane flat, and together they crawled across the undulating pipe, clutching at its smooth surface whenever a particularly large wave caused it to snap like a whip. Juan, who'd never suffered seasickness in his life, found the odd lurching motion nauseating. Sloane, too, looked a little worse for wear. 50 feet from the yacht, he had them slither forward so the crest of the pipe hid them from the boat until they were just a dozen or so feet away. They could see the yacht clearly where it was tied to a dock that itself was secured to the side of a pipe segment. Heavy-duty rubber fenders flexed and creaked to keep everything separated. Lights blazed from the yacht's windows while up on the bridge a lookout was silhouetted against the green glow of a radar monitor. They could see a tripod-mounted rocket launcher secured to the long foredeck. Had the corporation been running this operation, Juan would have fired the entire crew for poor light discipline. The yacht could be seen from a mile away, and an observer in a small boat could easily hide from the radar in the back clutter of the storm. Though he was forced to admit they had gotten a damn good bead on him and Sloane when they approached. They clung to the side of the pipe for nearly an hour, their bodies able to withstand their wet clothes and the cold wind because of the warm metal. Juan determined there were 4 men aboard the yacht and that they took turns monitoring the radar display on the bridge. For a while they took to carrying weapons with them, still hyped up after blowing apart the Oregon's lifeboat. But soon boredom dulled their vigilance and Juan could see they no longer had their machine pistols slung across their shoulders. With nothing but the element of surprise to overcome the 4-to-1 odds, Juan knew his best approach was stealth and then overwhelming savagery.
I'd better do this alone, he told Sloane, and slowly eased himself over the top of the pipe. The hard-edged timbre in his voice made her shudder. Cabrillo slid across the pipe and dropped nimbly to the floating dock, all the while never taking his eyes off the bridge watchstander, who was distracting himself by peering into the storm through a pair of night-vision goggles. He padded across the dock and lightly stepped over the gunwale and onto the yacht's aft deck. A sliding glass door led into the cabin, while a set of stairs integrated into the boat's fiberglass shell rose up to the bridge. The door was tightly sealed against the wind. Juan crouched low as he took the steps, twisting his head horizontal when he reached the top so only a sliver of his face could be seen from the bridge. The watchstander was still looking out at the sea. Moving so slowly that he appeared to be standing still, Juan inched up the rest of the way. A pistol was sitting on the dash, less than a foot from the man, who Juan noted had him by a good 3 inches and 30 pounds. The size difference meant strangling him silently was out of the question. He'd fight like a bull. Cabrillo crossed the 10 feet separating them when a strong gust hit the boat. The man was just reaching up to remove the goggles from around his head when Juan yanked his jaw with one hand and used the power of his shoulder to slam his forearm into the side of his skull. The paired forces torqued his spinal column past the breaking point and vertebrae separated with a discreet crack. He laid the corpse gently onto the deck. 3-1, he mouthed silently, feeling nothing for the killing because 2 hours earlier they had blown his boat out of the water without warning. He eased himself over the side of the bridge to a narrow catwalk that allowed access to the long forward deck from the aft section of the yacht. There were windows to his right and left. One was dark while the flicker of a television from the second cast an electric hue. He snuck a quick glance into the area where the TV was playing. One of the guards was sitting on a leather sofa watching a martial arts DVD, while another stood in the dimly lit kitchenette tending a teapot on one of the gas burners. He had a pistol in a shoulder holster. Juan couldn't tell if the other man was carrying. He could tell from their placement in the room that he wouldn't have a clear shot at either of them from the aft deck, and he had no idea where the fourth guard was. Presumably he was asleep, but Juan knew how easily presuming could get you killed. Juan leaned back over the polished aluminum railing to give himself a little room on the narrow walkway and opened fire. He put 2 rounds into the guy at the stove, the impact lifting his body up onto the lit burners. His shirt caught fire instantly. The guard on the couch had reflexes like a cat. By the time Juan swiveled the barrel and triggered off 2 more rounds, he was off the couch and rolling across the plush carpet. The bullets tore through the sofa and blew wads of ticking into the air. Juan adjusted his aim, but the guard had found cover behind a wet bar set against the far wall. He didn't have enough ammunition to blast away randomly and was already angry at himself for the 2 bullets he wasted on the couch. When the second guard emerged from behind the bar, he had his machine pistol ready and triggered off 1/2 a magazine in an uncontrolled burst. Cabrillo dove flat as glass shattered and bullets screamed above him. The spray of rounds ricocheted off the massive steel pipe behind him, zinging harmlessly into the night. He scrambled aft and fought the natural urge to roll off the boat and onto the dock. Instead, he gripped a stanchion that supported a retractable awning and whipped his body around it so that he was on the stairs again. He climbed as quickly as he could and leaned over the railing above the shattered window. The stubby barrel of the guard's machine pistol appeared, tracking back and forth as he sought his prey. When he couldn't see Cabrillo's body lying dead on the catwalk, his head and upper back emerged. He looked fore and aft, and when he still didn't see Cabrillo, he leaned out further so he could look down on the dock. Wrong direction, pal. The guard twisted his shoulders, trying to raise the scorpion.
Juan stopped him with one round through the temple. The machine pistol dropped into the gap between the boat and the dock. The Glock's sharp report gave his position away to the final guard. The bridge floor erupted with ragged holes as the gunman below sprayed the cabin ceiling. Juan tried to throw himself onto the dash, but staggered when a bullet blew his artificial foot in half. The kinetic force of the impact, plus his own momentum, vaulted him over the low windscreen and he rolled down the sloping wall of glass that fronted the lower cabin spaces. His back slammed into the foredeck, forcing the air from his lungs in an explosive whoosh. He levered himself onto his knees, but when he tried to stand, the mechanisms that controlled his foot refused to respond. His state-of-the-art prosthesis was now no more than a wooden peg leg. Inside one of the yacht's beautifully appointed cabins, he could see the fourth gunman silhouetted against the raging fire burning in the main salon. The propane line that fed the stove had burned through, and a roaring jet of liquid fire blasted upward, spreading flames across the ceiling from corner to corner. Molten plastic dripped onto the carpet, starting numerous smaller blazes. The guard had heard Juan's tumble over the roar of the inferno. He shifted his aim from his cabin ceiling to the main window and stitched the safety glass with bullets. A dozen crazed spiderwebs appeared in the wide pane, and chips rained down on Cabrillo like fistfuls of diamonds. Juan waited a beat and started to rise in order to fire back, and as he did, the guard burst through the weakened glass, slamming into his chest and knocking him flat once again. He managed to wrap an arm around the man's leg as they tumbled across the deck. The guard ended up on top of Cabrillo, but couldn't maneuver his machine pistol for a shot. He had Juan's gun hand pinned. The guard tried to smash his forehead against Juan's nose, but Cabrillo ducked his chin at the last second, and their skulls collided hard enough to make Juan's eyelids flutter. The guard then tried to ram his knee into Cabrillo's groin. He deflected the blow by twisting his lower body and absorbing the impact on his thigh. When the guard tried it again, Juan wedged a knee between the two of them and thrust upward with every ounce of his strength. He managed to lift the man off of him momentarily, but the guard was just as strong and tried to crush Cabrillo as he came back down. Juan had managed to lever his prosthetic limb up just enough so the dagger-sharp remains of his carbon fiber foot sliced into the taut muscles of his opponent's abdomen. Juan grabbed his attacker's shoulders, drawing the guard toward him at the same time he kicked hard with the leg. The sensation of the artificial limb sinking into the guard's stomach would haunt the chairman's nightmares for years to come. Juan pushed the guard aside as his screams gave way to wet gurgles, and finally, silence. He staggered to his feet. The back half of the yacht was engulfed in fire, flames torn almost horizontal by the powerful wind. There was no way to battle the conflagration, so Juan stepped to the side of the boat. He eased over the railing and lowered himself to the deck. He knelt and quickly rinsed his prosthesis in the sea. "Sloan," he shouted into the night, "you can come out now." Her face emerged over the top of the immense pipe, a pale oval against the dark night. Slowly, she rose from a crouch and came toward him. Juan hobbled across the deck to meet her. They were 2 feet apart when he saw her eyes go wide. Her mouth began to open, but Juan had already anticipated her warning. He whirled, his damaged leg kicking out from under him on the slick dock, yet still he raised the Glock as a fifth guard appeared on the yacht's foredeck, carrying a pistol in one hand and a briefcase in the other. He was also a second faster than Cabrillo. His weapon cracked once as Juan continued to lose his balance, falling as if in slow motion. Juan triggered off 2 rounds as his backside connected with the dock. The first missed, but the second impacted center mass. The guard's gun flew from his lifeless fingers, and the case clattered onto the floating pier. He turned to look at Sloane. She was on her knees, her hand pressed into her underarm. Her face was a mask of silent agony. Juan slithered to her side. "Hold on, Sloane. Hold on," he soothed. "Let me see." He gently raised her arm, causing her to suck air through her teeth. Tears leaked from her eyes. Her blood was hot and slick as Juan felt for the wound, and when he accidentally touched the torn flesh, Sloane cried out. "Sorry." He pulled her blouse away from her skin, wedged his fingers into the rent torn by the bullet, and ripped the fabric apart so he could see the entry point. He used a flap of cloth to softly wipe away some of the blood. The light from the burning yacht was wavering and erratic, but he could see that the bullet had gouged a 2-inch trench along the ribcage under her arm. He looked into her eyes. "You're going to be okay. I don't think it penetrated. It just grazed you."
"It hurts, Juan. Oh, sweet God, it hurts."
He held her awkwardly, mindful of her wound. "I know it does. I know."
"I bet you do," she said, stifling her pain. "I'm crying like a baby over this, when you had a leg shot off by the Chinese Navy."
"According to Max, when the shock finally wore off, I sounded like a whole nursery full of colicky infants."
"Wait here for a second." "Not like I'm going to go for a swim or anything."
Juan went back to the yacht. The fire was too advanced for him to recover anything from the cabins, but he managed to strip the guard he hadn't expected of a sports coat. The fact that he was wearing a $1,000 Armani blazer told him this guy wasn't a guard, but was most likely the head of this operation. A suspicion confirmed when the briefcase turned out to be a laptop computer.
"If it was important enough to save," Juan said, holding up the ThinkPad when he returned to Sloane's side, "it's important enough to retrieve. We have to put some distance between us and that boat. When its twin exploded against the side of the Oregon, she made one hell of a fireworks show."
It was almost as if they needed each other to move, Juan with his damaged prosthesis and Sloane with her wounded chest, but somehow they managed to stagger back to where Juan had stashed the satellite phone. He laid Sloane down onto the warm metal pipe and sat next to her so she could rest her head on his thigh. He covered her with the sports coat and stroked her hair until her body overcame the pain and she slipped into unconsciousness. Cabrillo opened the laptop and began to scan the files. It took him an hour to figure out what the 1,000-foot-long machine did, and another to discover that there were 39 more just like it nearby, arranged in 4 long rows. Although he still had no idea as to its purpose, dawn was an hour away when he finally figured out how to shut it down by plugging the laptop into a service portal under the access hatch where he'd hidden the phone. When the indicator light on the slim monitor showed that the machine was no longer generating electricity, even though its mechanisms were still responding to the action of the waves passing down its length, Juan checked his sat phone. He got a signal immediately. It was the massive electrical field created by the wave-driven generator and its clones that had played havoc with the electronics on the lifeboat, knocked out the phone, and made the compass needle spin out of control. With the generators offline, the field collapsed, and his telephone worked fine. He assumed the laptop had been hardened against the powerful EM pulses. He dialed a number and the phone on the other end was picked up after the 4th ring.
"This is the front desk, Mr. Hanley. You wanted a 4:30 wake-up call." "Juan? Juan!"
"Hiya, Max."
"Where the hell are you? We couldn't reach you on the lifeboat. You wouldn't pick up your phone. Even your transdermal locator wasn't broadcasting."
"Would you believe we're stuck in the middle of the ocean on the back of Papa Heinrich's giant metal snake? And have we stumbled into something weird?"
"You don't know the half of it, my friend.
You don't know the half of it.